Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel. How goes?
Welcome back, Sharon. It wasn't the same without you. I got to do the little beginning part, so that was different. But otherwise, I feel like I'm...
I thought it was very good. I listened to it from on a walk in Martha's Vineyard, which is where I got to go for a week, and I thought it was very good.
Yes, we had a lot of fun. It was a good time. But it's not the same without you, of course.
Yeah, you have to say that. Okay. Moving on. This week, the Wrap Steve Pond caught up with Ethan Hawke in the Czech Republic, of all places, to talk about Ethan's storied career, the state of independent filmmaking, and how doing a Marvel project is like this generation's version of doing a Western.
I absolutely love this interview. I'm so glad we are using it for the podcast. Everyone's going to get a kick out of it.
We love Ethan Hawke anyway. He's like one of the smartest and most thoughtful people in entertainment.
100%. It's a good listen. I can't wait for everyone to hear it. All right, Sharon, before that, let's get into some headlines. And here's how this one's going to work, right? I'm going to give you a bunch of movie headlines from this week. Okay. And when I'm done, you're going to tell me if the studios and the theater owners should feel good about the state of the industry or bad.
Okay. Ready? This is a great game. Let's go.
Yeah, here we go. Because there was a lot of stuff this week. All right. So first of all, Candyman opened to $22.3 million at the box office. It had a budget of just $25 million. So that's pretty good. Not too bad. Jungle Cruise crossed the $100 million mark domestically, and they've greenlit a sequel. So that's pretty good news. Mm-hmm. We've got a final trailer for the next James Bond film, No Time to Die, which is still headed towards the September 30th release in the UK and October 8th in the US. Good one to look forward to. Mm-hmm. This weekend, we get Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings at the box office, and it could actually break a Labor Day weekend record. That sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. But Paramount rained on the parade a little bit. They delayed the release of Mission Impossible 7, Top Gun Maverick, and Jackass Forever. They're now all going to be in 2022 releases. Two Tom Cruise movies pushed. That's, I always hate to see that. I love me a Tom Cruise movie. All right, Sharon, so talk to me. I've given you all of those headlines from the past week, some of which while you were out. How do you feel about the state of the box office?
I feel like the numbers are telling the story. When we're looking at where the box office is, it's about 71.2% off where it was 2 years ago. Now, I've been arguing about this with Jeremy Fuster, our box office reporter, who argues that that's not really a fair comparison because that summer there was a lot of Marvel stuff coming out. But the point is, even if it's only off by 60%, it's still a devastating landscape to be looking at. And by moving Top Gun and Mission Impossible out of this year, we just lost any chance of this year getting rescued in Q3 and Q4. So I am not an optimist about what is happening in theatrical. I think it's doing its best to hang on, but that's the best it's going to be able to do. One of the big movies that's coming up that you mentioned that has its last trailer coming out, this James Bond movie, was touted to the rooftops at the CinemaCon event for exhibitors in Las Vegas just a week ago. But these two big Tom Cruise movies has got to be giving MGM and really Amazon, which bought MGM, pause to think about, okay, if these theaters are not going to be open and actually, James Bond is very, very heavily weighted toward a European and US box office as a global, juggernaut. And those theaters are not open or people are not going, then do we go in October or do we wait? And if you're Amazon, of course, you have the possibility of streaming, but I don't think Barb Broccoli, who runs that franchise, would countenance that or even consider it. So the whole movie industry at the end of the day is between a rock and a hard place. And it's been this really excruciating tension for all these different releases now for a year and a half. So I don't envy anybody who's in distribution or running a movie studio at the moment. You can punt like Sony's been doing and sell off its movies like to Amazon and take a big check. And I have to say that's probably the best business decision in a lot of cases right now. So the Delta variant has just added insult to injury to this industry as we kept thinking we were going to be able to come out of it and have a proper summer and a proper Christmas, which are the two biggest seasons for the movie industry. So I think, you know, there's some movies that are doing okay. The Jungle Cruise, I think, was a good, you know, result. But you have to constantly say to yourself, relative to what? Relative to what the expectation was, or relative to what was the past normal, or relative to what the new normal is, or relative to not having a paid VOD option, right? Like all of those things are like, they're all contextualized. And overall, the reality is if you just look at the raw numbers, it's bad. Was that too much?
No, not at all. I agree. And I think even, you know, we'll see how it times out, but you know, on top of the Delta variant, now we have the weather. Hurricane Ida just, you know, pummeled the East Coast and New Orleans. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope everyone in those areas is doing all right. But like on top of everything, now we have the weather to worry about too.
Right, right.
For Shang-Chi this weekend, I don't know if that's going to convince, you know, if people are going to wait a weekend to go out and, or if they want to escape to get to the theater. I don't know. But it's just like, come on, can we get some break from this?
Yeah.
I was surprised. The Labor Day box office is usually not very big anyway. I think the all-time record is only like 30 million. So, and Shang-Chi is projected to do 40. So that's...
The all-time record for Labor Day is the $30 million opening? That doesn't sound right.
I know. Maybe I was completely off. In
No, we're going to double check those numbers for you. Dear listeners, forget that. We're going to check it. Yeah, Labor Day weekend should be a big weekend.
The largest Labor Day extended weekend is just 30.5 million held by Ram Zabi's 2007 remake of Halloween, according to the aforementioned Wrapped box office expert Jeremy Fuster. Ha, I remembered correctly.
All right. Okay, well, I stand corrected. I don't know. It's going to be a tough, forget about Labor Day as a standalone. It's going to be a tough fall and a tough winter. And, you know, and next year should be very interesting because there's going to be all these movies, huge movies opening. And that's what we had predicted for 2021. We're going to be packed with all of these movies, and you know, now we're not so much. So we'll see.
It's going to be very interesting to see what people's tolerances are like in 2022, because there might be a movie worth seeing almost every weekend or every other weekend. As you said, it's going to be an absolutely jam-packed schedule.
But that also presumes that we normalize the COVID situation, and I don't know that we are entirely certain of that either. That's the thing, is that it makes planning really, really impossible. So, you know, like you, I am a fan of the theater experience. I actually happened to see one of the Toronto movies early yesterday on a huge screen on the Warner Brothers lot. Yeah, Dune. I got to see Dune. It's big. It's epic. It's very beautifully made. And I'll leave the rest to our critics. And I'm not supposed to talk about it. I think it's under embargo. But anyway, so like I said, it's big. I hope nobody gets mad that I said that. And it's beautifully made. But, It is really an experience you absolutely 1,000% want to see on a big screen, for sure. So I presume that Denis Villeneuve wants people to see it there too. Anyway, we will see, and we will, of course, continue following the story and talking about it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Ding dong, the witch is dead. And that is how Jeopardy legend James Holzhauer reacted to the news that Mike Richards was out as executive producer of Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. The move, of course, follows the earlier news that Mike Richards would not be taking over as the new host of Jeopardy, as was decided merely days before the reverse of that decision, which followed a backlash to some old lawsuits and some very ugly comments he made on a podcast. Daniel, was there any other way this story could have ended?
No, I think as soon as he was let go from one job, it was only a matter of time till he lost the other one as well. I think the idea that he would still be a part of it just wouldn't have sat well with people. And I couldn't imagine what it was like to work on those shows with him there. He seemed like he really schemed and manipulated his way into this job, and that he treated people, he had a checkered past. So I don't know if the average fan of Jeopardy would have necessarily stopped watching. The ratings haven't certainly reflected that, but I think it would have tarnished the entire place to just have him still there. And It brings an end to what has to go down as maybe one of the worst handlings of a situation in terms of like replacing a host, how there was no plan, how they had no idea what they were doing from the beginning. I mean, this was just botched on every single level. I cannot imagine doing a worse job.
But how do you really feel about it?
I don't know. And the thing is that, you know, to anyone who watched the show without context, Mike Richards was fine. If they had just come out and said right away, they're like, this is going to be our guy, I think it would have been received a lot better than putting on what in retrospect felt like a fake guest host sort of competition thing when, you know, the guy doing the picking had himself picked the entire time. He was perfectly fine as a host. I thought he was as good as anyone else was.
Well, and you are the person who would know, since I confess to not being a Jeopardy watcher, but I'm certainly a watcher of the Jeopardy drama about Jeopardy.
Yeah, you know, I think, and I do think it's one of those things where like the drama wasn't actually affecting people's enjoyment of the show. I don't personally, like, I don't know if I ever stopped watching no matter what they did, but
yeah. Right, because there's bigger fish to fry, like all the crap that's going on in the world everywhere. Like, who really needs to care about the drama going on behind the curtain? And all you really want to know is
to wax off about the entire planet in about 5 minutes, people. Yes, you're right. All right. Finally, this week, speaking of things to wax off about, podcast host Joe Rogan announced that he has COVID. But Jaron, don't worry. He is getting top-notch medical treatment. If by top-notch you mean he's doing completely nonsensical things bordering on ridiculous and stupid. Mm. Rogan's treatment plan, he says, includes, quote, monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin.
That's not ridiculous and stupid. Apparently, monoclonal antibodies are good. But go continue.
But that's like if you are showing symptoms and if you're, you know, if it's worse for you, that can work. Ivermectin, which I think that's the one that's a horse dewormer. He took a Z-Pak, which is what you, when you have a cold, prednisone, which is a steroid, which again, you would take if you're in bad shape, an anti-D drip. I don't even know what that is. And a vitamin drip. Like he had a cold. None of those remedies, air quotes, make any sense for him for a number of reasons, including the fact, like I just said, Rogan is not a horse. So this
looks like that guy on the tweeters that he's not a cat and Rogan is not a horse.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure he's not a horse. So this seems stupid and we make fun, but Rogan has the number one podcast on Spotify and a massive audience that he spouts his thoughts to daily. Jaron, do you think Spotify has any obligations to like kind of like correct him or muzzle him or do anything in this situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And why haven't we read stories about what Spotify's responsibility is in this case? Spotify has very much the same responsibility, I would say, as Twitter and Facebook.
I was going to make that same case.
That have
I
been agree 100%. In the crosshairs for spreading disinformation about COVID and making it harder for this country and thus the world to get past the pandemic. So, yeah, I want to know what Spotify has to say about what Joe Rogan and potentially any other podcaster has to say. And it really should have, that question really needed to be raised despite the fact or before the fact that Joe Rogan actually got COVID.
Yeah, because he's been saying dumb shit.
I don't know how it escaped. First of all, it's problematic to say the least. It's almost like a lot of this stuff, like it's hard to even know what to say or what to think because it feels very much parallel university. Don't we all agree that 1 + 1 = 2 and that the sun comes up in the morning and then it goes, sets at night, and that a virus may respond in a lab to a certain kind of concoction by our scientists who then test it and tell you what the results are. I don't know, but I think that it's really damaging to our discourse. I just keep thinking about how mind-blowing it is that all of this really came from the presidency of Donald Trump and the forces that he unleashed and how long these are continuing to ripple through society, whether that's not trusting government, not trusting media, offering with, you know, very brazenly incorrect facts to the public or encouraging them to either disbelieve institutions, whether it's the FBI or the CDC. The question that, that's a distribute, drawing a distinction between holding people, holding institutions to account versus just presuming that they are, in fact, the CDC is trying to put a chip in you when they're giving you a vaccine.
Bill Gates is watching.
Bill Gates is watching. No, that's Mark Zuckerberg is watching, Daniel.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg is watching. I thought it was Bill Gates is tracking people with the COVID vaccine.
But actually, Mark, what I'm saying is Mark Zuckerberg actually is watching because Facebook can see you do and those Google. But, you know, the fact, I mean, I sort of lost my train of thought there, but we basically, there's a lot of continuing very, very serious implications of what has happened to having a commander in chief who allowed all of these things to grow and fester. And so Joe Rogan is really a symptom of all of that rather than the main cause. Oh, I know what I was going to say. It was an interesting thing that I noticed. The Washington Post turned off comments on a story that it had this week about four conservative various talk show hosts who have now all died of COVID. All people who had encouraged their listeners to be skeptical of the vaccine and not to take it. Apparently, the comments on that story, which simply pointed out that four people who were against the vaccine have died of the disease that the vaccine will protect you from, had gotten so so hairy that, and so I don't know if it was like there was violence threatened or what, but they had to turn off the comments. So this is unwinding. This is going to take a lot of time, you know. And all I can say is, it becomes, challenging as we as journalists and the job that we have, and sort of continuing to report facts and just try to turn down the volume of people who are trying to undermine what it is that we do. And we really have to stick to our mission. I think it's the only thing we can do. But I think we need to ask Spotify.
It's funny to me that he would do seven things to try and treat this instead of doing like the one thing he could have done that was super easy to not get it in the first place. Like, if you don't trust medicine, why are you even taking any of those things?
That's exactly the through-the-looking glass thing.
It reminds me of Kirk Cousins as a quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings. He is not vaccinated. And, you know, he said that he would, you know, like even like put up like plexiglass around him in certain meeting rooms. And he said he would do everything in his power to make sure he'd stay safe. Except the one thing that would actually work.
Yeah. No, you brought that up before, and I think it's totally valid.
I know. It's still in my head. All right. Mm-hmm. On that somber note, as always, we like to conclude this segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, which allows our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she's particularly into or happy this week. Spoiler alert, there's nothing. That's the Wax On. And the Wax Off, things that she is upset about, worked up about, depressed, sad, all of the emotions. Sharon, as always, the floor.
Why, thank you. Well, you know, I know I said that nothing good happened this week, but I'm just going to give a nod in our Wax On to something that I experienced and also wrote about earlier this summer, which is the beauty of summer. And it's a gorgeous time of year. It's coming to an end toward Labor Day, and I was lucky enough to get to be on an island with my kids on the East Coast and enjoy the beautiful, beautiful things that summer brings, the beach and the surf and the forest and the hiking and the wonderful corn and tomatoes and everything we love to eat in the summertime and barbecuing and all that kind of really basic stuff. That the trip was sandwiched between Hurricane Ida on the front end and Hurricane Ida on the back end. So I got very lucky and escaped it. But the piece that I wrote that I'm recommending was titled A Summer of Beauty and Dread, which is this enjoyment underpinned by the sense of apocalypse everywhere. So I recommend that piece. That's my Wax On. My Wax Off is, you won't be surprised that this really is a day, a week where it feels like there's just nothing good happening between the all the images that we've had of the pullout from Afghanistan that have left women, the women of Afghanistan, frightened and depressed, in some cases suicidal about the lack of a future that the rule under life under the Taliban will hold for them. And then in our own country, of course, the news that Texas has effectively ended Roe v. Wade and the right to have an abortion, functionally speaking, for women in the second largest state in the union, and that our Supreme Court, instead of defending the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade, which has stood for 50 years, decided to duck and avoid it. And so it felt last night, it was 9 p.m. here, it was midnight in Washington, D.C., when the Supreme Court issued its decision not to review the ban on abortion that the Texas law represents. I think women all over the country felt like they'd been kicked in the gut and felt, and all day long, it's just been all over my feed, that women just feel like so deeply disrespected. Many people I saw on Twitter were pointing out how people who declare that it is their personal right to decide whether or not to wear a mask for themselves suddenly decide that it's okay to decide for a woman whether she's going to have a baby or not. There's just a cognitive dissonance there that is so deep, profoundly disturbing, and also feels deeply undemocratic. So I know that pendulums swing one way and then ultimately they always do swing the other way, and that this Texas terrible law will be challenged in court sooner, I suppose, rather than later. But at the moment, it looked like this idea that private citizens can go out and sue anybody who gives a woman an abortion is licensed for any state to pass something similar in the Supreme Court, rather than actually have to stand up and make a decision and take the hit for knocking down Roe v. Wade, would instead just sidestep the issue and say, no, sorry, we can't, it's too complicated, it involves private citizens. Seems like a pretty wide opening for people who want to just make other people do what they want by passing a law that allows private citizens to sue them, and functionally that nobody can pursue their personal choices because they live under the threat of somebody else suing them for their personal choices. That's not the democracy that we want to live in. I'm quite sure of that. And I am sad, like so many people are sad. That's my wax off.
Well said. I don't know. I don't have the words for Texas. I never have. All right, that does it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we have our fantastic interview with the one and only Ethan Hawke. Stay tuned. The Wraps Awards editor Steve Pond sat down recently with Ethan Hawke. The two were in the Czech Republic, where Hawke received the President's Award and screened First Reformed, his 2017 film from director Paul Schrader. It's a fantastic conversation. I think you're going to love it. Take a listen.
I mean, I feel like it wasn't just that you had that moment, because it feels like right now you've got The Guilty coming out in mm-hmm. in Toronto in a couple of weeks, right? You've got a couple other things going. I mean, it just feels like you're in another moment where you're doing all kinds of interesting stuff right on top of each other.
You know, the truth is that I just always put one foot in front of the other. Just I've tried to keep moving my whole life. Sometimes feel like a cat, you know, just trying to stay alive. But one of the things that's happened in the way the film business has changed is independent movies take so much less time to make. They have so much less money in there. So you end up being able to... When I was younger, it'd be a big deal if you made two movies in a year, you know. But now, but that was because most movies took about 4 or 5 months to make, you know, with prep. And now, you know, we shot First Reformed in 5 weeks. We shot Juliet Naked in 6 weeks. I did a Robert Eggers film this year, which was the first film in a while that I've done that was really, well, Robert really strives for a level of excellence that's really exciting. And it was one of the rare times where you're making an independent movie that has a real financial budget around it.
Yeah.
And so he was able to work at a pace that was more like it was when I started.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Lighthouse was
a masterpiece. Yeah, yeah, me too.
And this one doesn't feel like it's going to feel any smaller than that.
No, no, it'll feel a lot bigger than that. But it's just as adventuresome. I mean, who knows? What's fun about Robert is he goes and dances out on the edge, you know?
Yeah.
I don't have no idea if it'll work, but it was certainly thrilling to be a part of.
Right. So when you're doing something like that, do you really not have a clue as to what it's going to look like or how it's going to work?
In my heart, I have clues.
Right.
You know, it seems arrogant to suppose. You know, I've never thought I was doing something interesting, and then it turned out not to be interesting. How things, you know, like take a movie like Gattaca, for example. I love that movie, and I felt confident when we were doing that movie that it was worth watching, that it was going to be extremely interesting. And then it comes out, and people didn't like it, and they didn't respond. But eventually they did.
Right.
And the same with Before Sunrise. You know, there's a lot of movies I've done now that in their first brush with the public, they're kind of met with indifference. But it just takes time for them to find their audience.
Mm-hmm. You
know? I'm curious. It's funny. Recently I've been getting a lot of nice feedback about Juliet Naked, just since you mentioned, which I really like too, but nobody really paid much attention to it when it came out. Over the pandemic, I got a lot of emails from people who would, like, I guess they got bored of watching certain things and were looking for something else, and they found it, and they enjoyed it. And it's always fun to watch that happen.
I thought that was one where I bought the book as soon as it came out because I love Nick Hornby's writing, and especially when he's dealing with music.
I know. I
nobody.
Well, you and I obviously have a shared passion for music, you know, and nobody does it better than him.
Yeah, and I felt like it really got to the heart of the book, of what I loved about the book. I mean, it felt like it was there on screen.
Those two characters in the book are Chris O'Dowd character and my character are kind of inverses of each other. The one who does it and doesn't want to do it, the one who doesn't do it but wants to do it. And they were great foils for each other. I love that. He has my favorite moment in that movie where he talks about the joy of being a fan the artistry of being a fan.
Oh, yeah. There's a line that leads into that I thought was...
I know the line you mean, but I can't quote it right now. Yeah. But it's the reason I did the movie.
It's like you go into a little tirade at the table, and he says something that then leads him to talk about what it means to be a fan.
The love of being a fan. Yeah. And I remember when I read that in the script, I was like, shit, that's brilliant. That's how I feel. And in that moment in the movie is lifted right out of the book.
Right.
You know, and it's one of the best moments of the movie, I think.
Right. I mean, I think when we talked about that before, you said something along the lines of it's never been easier to make an independent movie
and it's never
harder to get people to see it.
It's so true. I mean, you know, it's strange, even a movie like First Reformed, without the journalists, that movie would have been lost, you know. It's so hard to compete in an atmosphere. You know, what Paul says, which I think is brilliant and true, is there's so many movies that come out right now that do all the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they really... they don't ask much of the audience. And that can create a feeling in an audience that they can be resentful when they get asked something of. Even though that's the joy of being a film goer, is participating. You know, when you watch One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, it doesn't do all the work. It invites you into a dialogue with it. It doesn't dictate to you exactly. What does it mean when the chief throws the sink through the window? What does it mean? I don't know. But you feel something and you can talk about it. And you know that Paul line that he says, a really great movie starts when you walk out of the theater. You know, that's I feel that way. And it's most contemporary movies end when the credits roll.
Right.
You know, it's over. You're never going to think about that again.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you're here sort of getting a career achievement award of sort. I mean, do you look back at art? I mean, I'm just wondering, when you started, are there things that meant a lot to you then that don't now, and vice versa?
For me, life has happened a lot faster than anticipated. Meaning, I'm shocked to find how interested I am in the same things I was when I was younger.
Really?
I remember the first time I went to the first festival I went to was the Venice Film Festival with Dead Poets Society. And watching a community of people celebrate film in that way, and it's different than the marketplace. You know, there's this feeling, especially in America, at these, you know, just like you said, a roundtable interview, press junkets, everything's publicity for sales. And you get to a film festival, and it feels more like a celebration of movies.
Right.
And that, that to me, it's just more interesting. It's like, it's the one place where the metric isn't accumulation of wealth. You know, right. There's great respect for films that are never going to make any money.
Yeah.
And a great reverence for them. And I enjoy that game because it changes the playing field, and it creates a different set of rules that I think are more ambitious and more exciting. And there's a great Flannery O'Connor line about, I'd rather have one reader in 100 years than 100 today. You know, and film festivals are along that line of like, what actually is happening right now that is worth talking about?
Right. Yeah, I always think it's great. You go to a film festival, and I think it's the act of going somewhere just to see movies. You end up with a line around the theater for a movie that probably most of those people, if it was playing at the multiplex at the end of their street, wouldn't go.
I know, and it's so. I had a, right before the pandemic started, I was a juror at Sundance, and it had been a long time since I had seen 16 movies in 8 days or something.
Right.
It had been a long, like when I was younger, I used to do that all the time. You know, I'd watched 2-3 movies a day for weeks on end.
I
found it unendingly interesting. But life happens and you get busy, and I don't know about other people, but I often have trouble watching the movie I want to watch at home because my kids or my wife don't want to watch it, or they want to watch something else. So to get to just watch, I forget how it was, 16, 19 movies or whatever, and I just felt madly in love with the medium again. Or I felt that love, maybe not again, but it was vibrant. And that's what I mean when I say that I haven't... time has happened faster than I thought. I remember when I first started, I assumed by midlife I would go into another profession.
Really?
I couldn't imagine. I guess I would have. It's a little bit like sex or something. You think you might get bored of it, but you just don't. It just keeps being interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I feel about acting. Just it maintains, and it just gets more interesting in a lot of ways to me as you learn more about it. It's really, really difficult to make one good movie, and there's no math to it. There's some math, but it's a very difficult equation to figure out and to get all the pieces right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to ask about The Guilty, because I love the original Danish version. Is it the same?
You know, the truth is, it's the same. But that, for me, is a very small part of my life. I was a favorite of Antoine Fuqua, who I love.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm a reoccurring voice in it. It's like,
right.
I'm it.
Okay.
And I'm, you know, it's really just Jake all the time, 24/7. But he gives a great performance. And I love Antoine. You know, Antoine and I have you know, we did Training Day and Brooklyn's Finest and Magnificent Seven together. And I just like being around him making right. movies. I just like his energy, and I like the way that he cares and the way that he thinks. And I think he's a really underappreciated film director. You know, he has a kind of peck and paw toughness and anti-authority streak to right. all his films that I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the other stuff you've got coming up, I mean, I know, what was it? There was the one that, I think the Blumhouse one that they just showed a bit of it at CinemaCon or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And the word came out that, you know, Ethan Hawke is terrifying in this one. What's that like?
One of the jobs of an actor that is probably the biggest part of my job that people is deciding what to do and how to do it. I mean, helping filmmakers that you believe in get their work made is a big part of what we
right.
do. And Scott taught me a lot about movies. He's in a lot of ways, you know, my first experience was with Joe Dante, who'd come out of mm-hmm. Roger Corman, and Joe had an unbelievable, you know, before Quentin Tarantino was Joe Dante as far as, like, who could be the biggest film geek
right.
of all time. And do you know Joe at all?
Yeah, I was on the set of Small Soldiers for a while. For Premiere Magazine, and so I spent a fair amount of time back then talking to Joe. I mean, and it really was, you know, it was like every little thing in that movie, even though it was just fun. Oh, and also, what was the one? The Burbs,
the one
you did,
with Tom Hanks,
where the Writers Guild was on strike, so the actors improvised most of the movie because they couldn't officially do rewrites.
Yeah,
but it was like Joe was always just a really fun guy to hang
around.
He's
a fun guy to fall in love with movies about, and he taught me at a young age about like no difference between high and low art. It's just about are you working hard?
Right.
Do you love what you do, and do you care about it, and do you care about every frame, and are you sowing secrets into it? And you know, Bergman sows secrets, and so does you know, the best genre directors. And Scott, I had a great experience on Sinister with him, and that was my first experience with that genre of, you know, horror. And The Black Phone is really personal to him, and I just wanted to help him get it made,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I'm glad that people freaked out over the trailer. You know, I kind of feel like when all's said and done, as an actor, I want to have, you know, I have these little boxes I want to check. Like, can you make a great Western? Can you make a great romance? Can you make a great, you know, art film? Can you make a great horror movie? Can you make a great comedy? Can you make a great... They're all so damn hard to do. And so I love putting myself inside different genres to try to create a larger life's work, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, because you're also now in the Marvel Universe coming up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you have to... I feel like if you were an actor in the 50s, you know, they made Westerns. If you're an actor in 2020, you know, you got to play ball with Marvel. You know? I've been having I'm really fortunate because we're dealing with a story that doesn't have a lot of ancillary baggage. Like if you play Spider-Man or Batman,
right.
You see, they got so much baggage to them. They have so much baggage. Meaning the audience have such expectations,
yeah.
And it's like playing Hamlet or something. You can't play it in a vacuum. You're playing it in relationship to the other Hamlets.
Right.
Whereas with the Moon Knight, people don't know much about it. It doesn't have a lot of baggage. Oscar is giving an absolutely phenomenal performance that it feels exciting to be mm-hmm. a part of with him.
Right. So is your character not really a known character within that
world? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's, I've signed 10,000 NDAs and I get yelled right. at every time I say anything about it. They're very secretive about it. They like to create a lot of anticipation. But it's been, I understand why people love working for them because they're extremely active friendly. Mm-hmm. They really, the whole organization is oriented around, they do good world building and create space for actors. If you want to have, if you want to play, they want you to play.
Yeah. So are you looking for, are you working on stuff now for you to direct? Or, I mean, I know you just produced Good Lord Bird, which was sort of insane in a good way.
Yeah. I love that. You know, that was, you know, after Blaze, that was kind of my life's project. That mm-hmm. was, you know, that was about 4 years of my life went into the Good Lord Bird. I love that so much. To be honest with you, I've been trying to put myself back together after that experience, you know, just really? Try to, you need a little time to figure out where to put your energy. You know, that all my energy went to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm doing a documentary right now about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward.
Oh.
And that's been kind of my pandemic project.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been pouring myself into that. I turned 50, and it seems like a really fun moment to step back for a second and study two people that did my profession about as well as it could be done.
Right.
It's very rare to have people, you know, they both had really long careers. And how to sustain a level of excellence over a long period of time, how not to kind of give in to the vanities of the profession or the how to not be jaded. Yeah, it's hard. Mm-hmm. Life beats so many people up through success, through failure, through indifference, whatever. There's so many variables, all of which can lead you to self-loathing. And those two stayed alive, you know?
Yeah.
They stayed alive and they figured out how to give back and they figured out how to have a family and they figured out there were two people that were born with a lot that did a lot with it.
Yeah.
You know?
And, so how far along are you on that?
Damn close.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's been one of the biggest endeavors I've ever, like trying to make sense out of a narrative out of a big life. I mean, you can make a documentary about what happened at the Actors Studio. I mean, it's hard to imagine Paul Newman and James Dean and Marlon Brando and Carl Malden and Geraldine Page and Marilyn Monroe all in the same acting class.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to imagine. And they changed storytelling. And then the rest of their life kind of vibrated off.
Yeah.
Off that moment. I don't know. I expect that I'll be done by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they'll probably come out next year.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I imagine something like that. Everybody that goes to see that movie is going to walk in with this image of what Paul Newman is
mm-hmm.
to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I really want to make it before the, you know, the people who are kind of my age and older. I think it will mean a lot because their legacy is kind of turned into philanthropy mm-hmm. and you forget what massive artists they were.
Yeah.
And it's a credit to that you've got, I mean, Paul Newman in the height of his life was about as big as a Beatle. I mean, you couldn't be right. a bigger cinema icon than he achieved. And yet his giving overshadowed it. It's hard to imagine.
Right.
And, you know, most of the people that achieve high levels at my profession, the story ends kind of sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you talk about James Dean or Monty Clift or Brando, there's a kind of, you know, it's to have a 50-year marriage and to have the final act of his work life, you know, The Verdict, Color of Money, Nobody's Fool.
Mm-hmm.
Those are three of his greatest performances
yeah.
that happened in the last chapter. So as a guy like me, you can imagine that's kind of an exciting thing to think about.
Right. Yeah. So are you doing anything else on music? I feel like you've got such a good sense for that.
Yeah. The The thing that I'm acting in next that I'm really excited about is a two-hander with Ewan McGregor. We're playing two brothers, and I'm going to play a musician again, and I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
And that is it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners, and remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.